This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Luther, you talk about proving people wrong. What are you out to prove?
I'm the best.
We're back, live with more Rami Makhlouf on 670 The Score in Odyssey Station.
Hour two of three with you here on The Score Evening Show. We'll get into some Cubs a little later this hour, and with my guest Megan Montemurro coming up at 8 o'clock from the Chicago Tribune. But you heard there, Bears second round pick, Luther Burden III, asking what he is out to prove to people in the NFL. He says that I am the best. Joining me now to talk a little bit about Luther Burden, former Gators wide receiver, NFL vet, now analyst for ESPN, the SEC Network, and the co-host of SEC This Morning on SiriusXM Radio. Pleasure to welcome in Chris Doering. Chris, how are you this evening, my man?
I'm good, man. Thanks for having me on.
Were you surprised to see Luther Burden slip all the way to the Bears at pick number 39 in the second round?
I was shocked. I mean, honestly, this is a guy heading into the season that we were feeling could potentially be a top 10 pick. I think he's got a top 10 talent. I think, unfortunately, there's this mindset among some people that he's not a hard worker, or he's got bad body language, or he's not a good teammate. But everybody that I've talked to in that locker room, including Eli Drinkwitz, the head coach of the Missouri Tigers, speaks about what a pleasure it's been to coach him, to have him part of that program. And this is a guy that can beat you in a number of different ways. He can catch the ball around the line of scrimmage, make you miss and go the distance. He can take the top off the defense. He can return kicks for you too. So you've got a dangerous ball carrier now out there in Chicago here that has a chip on his shoulder. And I think that's a dangerous thing for Luther Burden.
Do you have a comp for him in terms of an NFL player who's at that level right now who you could see him developing into and have a similar game to?
Oh, man. You know what? I hadn't really thought about that one. And off the top of my head, I don't want to press it there. So I don't know that I have one, but I think, you know, you're seeing in football now where guys are being utilized. You started in high school. You find a way to get your best player the football. You know, this is a guy that can take it from a direct snap as a wildcat quarterback. He can get it on the jet sweep. You get it to him a number of different ways. But he's a guy that's really dangerous. And I think you're starting to see that filtrate up through the college and into the NFL ranks. So let's just not overthink it. Let's find a way to get our best player the football. And I think Caleb's going to have a good one to distribute it to.
Yeah, I think a lot of Bears fans are already putting him in the slot position because you got DJ Moore and Roma Dunze out here who are more the traditional outside wide receivers. But knowing Ben Johnson and how creative he can get with an offense, and just the way you're describing Luther Burden, sounds like he could be anywhere on the field at any given moment.
Yeah, and that's kind of the way that he was used at Missouri, too. Could line up anywhere certainly, you know, I think they could have done a better job of getting the ball in his hands even more at times. But he's a guy that really doesn't have a whole lot of limitations when it comes to playing both on offense and special teams.
What's his route running ability? Is that something that he's got to work on, or is he pretty tight, pretty sharp when it comes to getting off the line with his routes?
Yeah, I don't know how many of your listeners heard about some of the controversy as the lead up to the draft, but people were criticizing his route running ability. And so Missouri reportedly sent NFL scouts and coaches some cut-ups from practice, one-on-ones that he was doing. And I got a chance to watch that. It was released. I think Matt Miller put it out, but it was a great display of patience at the line of scrimmage versus press coverage. Creativity with his routes. I think he does a good job of double moving at the top of his stems, catches the ball really well. So, yeah, I think there is room for improvement, but I don't think he's as bad as a lot of people try to describe him being when it comes to route running. And I think you know, there are folks that have talked about him not running routes full speed, not necessarily, you know, being a guy that's dependable every single down. That is not my interpretation of watching him play, both in what I've seen, you know, for 3 years of college football covering the SEC, as well as what I've seen in practice from him.
Talking with Chris Doering of the SEC Network, ESPN. You can catch him on SEC This Morning over on Sirius XM Radio. And talking about Luther Burden III, the Bears' second-round pick, I hear similar things with him as I hear with their first-round pick, Colston Loveland. Both of them with sort of maybe a step back production-wise their senior year in college, but I hear people attributing both of those drops in production to maybe more the situation, the circumstance that they were in. Is that how you see the drop-off for Luther Burden from his junior year to his senior year?
Yeah, I don't think he got worse by any means. You know, I do think that you know, Kirby Moore has done a tremendous job as the offensive coordinator there in Como, but I think they could have targeted him a little bit more. You know, he's one of those guys, you got to get the football in his hands, you know, 10 to 15 times if you can. So I think there were also a number of other good complementary receivers around Luther Burden too, which, you know, Theo Weiss ended up having a really good season as well. So there were some factors. I definitely don't think the numbers declining are any cause for alarm or any reflection on him declining in his ability or desire to play hard.
Talking with Chris Doering of the SEC Network and ESPN here on the Score Evening Show. Do you think he's NFL ready? Do you think he can step in on day one and compete at this level, or is there some development that needs to happen?
Well, I mean, I think there certainly is some development to be able to tap into the potential that is there, but I think he's NFL ready right now from the get-go. And you mentioned the Bears' current situation. So nice to have a couple established guys that can help, you know, take some of the pressure off LB3, and he can kind of acclimate at his own pace. But I when you have somebody that's as dangerous with the ball in his hands as Burden is, you find ways to even if you're limiting what you're throwing to him in terms of the whole playbook, you know, finding some packages that can play to his strengths. So I have no doubt that he's going to be productive from day one with the Bears.
I feel like you've alluded to this a couple times already in our discussion here, but you just talked about what he does when the ball is in his hands. One of the things Ben Johnson emphasized in his post-draft press conference was there's going to be competition on this roster. He said there are no depth charts right now until they get out on the field and start working some of this stuff out. One of the raps on Luther Burden was he maybe doesn't run the same routes when he's not getting the ball as he does when he is getting the ball. Is that unfair? Is that an unfair criticism of him, or is that something that we should keep an eye on here in Chicago?
I know people have said that about him, and again, when I've talked to Eli Drinkwitz, the coach there in Missouri, has never indicated that being an issue from his perspective. I know you see a lot of different offenses now that don't ask the backside receivers to go full speed and effort. When you're a tempo team, you're not necessarily, you know, tagging the backside with any route. So I don't know if that's, you know, if he's playing within the structure of the offense, or there are times where he's not necessarily giving it his all. But yeah, I mean, if that's the case, that's certainly something that has to be corrected. And by Coach Johnson emphasizing the need to compete, you know, hopefully that'll, along with the chip on his shoulder, motivate him to play hard every single snap. But I tell you what, man, you go back and watch the tape from the last couple of years. When there is a clutch moment and a need for a play, they get the ball to him. Maybe no bigger one than the catch against South Carolina at the end of that ball game. He's a playmaker, and you could tell that the quarterback that he's played with, when they need something to happen, they know where number three is.
What about his blocking ability? Because that was something else that Ben Johnson said that they'll be watching when receivers and tight ends are not getting the ball in their hands is how physical are they going to be, and are they going to help move the ball down the field?
Yeah, I mean he's shown moments of being physical in the run game. I think he can be a little more consistent there as well. But I think that's something that comes with what's emphasized in the locker room. And again, it sounds like Ben Johnson is certainly trying to open things up to make people, you know, motivated to compete for their opportunities.
While I got you here, and since you do cover the SEC over there on ESPN and the SEC Network and mornings on Sirius XM Radio, another SEC draft pick for the Bears, and this one, Shamar Turner, the defensive tackle out of Texas A&M. What can you tell us about him? What are your impressions of him early on?
No, man, he's a good one. That defense, I mean, you go back and look at him and Shamar Stewart and Walter Nolan before he transferred to Ole Miss, they have some studs, and he is a productive, athletic, big, strong, physical, fast dude. So Chicago definitely doing a good job by tapping into the talent of the SEC there, and Shamar will be a guy that I think can compete from day one for an opportunity to start.
Now, he has said himself that he's got to rein it in a little bit. The first thing he was asked about in his introduction to the Chicago media was an incident with an Ole Miss offensive lineman who he gave a shot right to the midsection, if you know what I mean, Chris, last year during an altercation. Is that a major concern? Or honestly, from my viewpoint, I kind of like that. I like a little nasty. You do have to draw the line and sort of rein it in a little bit. You don't want the 15-yard penalties too often. But I like a little nasty from my guys, especially the ones that are down there in the trenches.
Yeah, I don't necessarily look at him as a guy that's an undisciplined player or somebody that's a cheap shot artist. That was a cheap shot. But in the flow of a ball game, when emotions are running high, sometimes you see that happen. But I don't think that's the norm for Shamar by any means. So until I see some further illustrations of that, I'm refusing to think of him as anything other than a guy that plays hard and plays with his emotions on his sleeve.
Can you move him inside and outside, or is he purely a defensive tackle?
No, I mean, I think he's shown the versatility to do both, and that Texas A&M defense, they've moved those guys around a lot. So That's kind of the theme amongst defenses, not only in college but the NFL now, the versatility and the opportunity to move guys around in different packages to get your best pass rushers on the field at the same time is something that you know, he's used to dating back to his days at A&M.
Did he slip a little further than you thought he would? You said you thought Luther Burden was a first round, maybe even top 10 talent. Did you think Shamar Turner was somebody who would go closer to the top of the second round, maybe late first round?
I don't necessarily know that he was a first-round guy in my mind. Probably about where I thought he would end up. But, you know, I'm partial, having played in this league and covering the league. But when you get an opportunity to draft a guy from the SEC, man, my experience was the jump from high school to college was much greater than the one from college to the NFL, just because a lot of those guys I was playing against on Sundays were guys that I had already played against for years at Florida in the SEC, and I think the same holds true. So getting a handful of SEC guys out of this past draft for Chicago, I think will help them both in terms of guys that can play immediately and guys that are acclimated to the type of talent that the NFL has.
That is Chris Doering, former Gators wide receiver, NFL vet, current analyst for ESPN and the SEC Network. And catch him on SEC This Morning on Sirius XM Radio. And follow him on Twitter, at Chris Doering. Chris, really appreciate the time and the insight, man. Have yourself a great night.
Thank you, man. Good catching up. Take care.
Appreciate it. I really like what I heard from Chris Doering. By the way, he joins me on the Score Hotline presented by Circus Sports Illinois. Download the Circus Sports app today. I mean, I'd heard that the Bears, as long as he's got his head on straight with Luther Burden III, that they got themselves a steal and somebody who was a potential first-round talent. He called him a top-10 talent, and he doesn't seem to think that some of these character issues or effort issues that maybe moved him down the board are that much of an issue. He thinks they were maybe a little bit overblown, especially when it comes to the route running, and kind of the same thing with Shamar Turner and talking about some of the character stuff with him that earned him a couple of 15-yard penalties during his time out there at Texas A&M. He doesn't seem to think that these knocks on these guys are maybe as valid as they've been made out to be in the lead up to the NFL draft. You hope he's right, because if he is, the Bears got two absolute steals in those two guys, Luther Burden with pick number 39 and then Shamar Turner a little bit later on in that draft. So we shall see. My thanks again to Chris Doering for joining me. Catch him on the SEC Network and SEC This Morning. We'll hit a quick break on the other side, switch gears and talk some Cubs, talk some baseball. Does this season feel real familiar to you? Because it maybe should. We'll talk about that right after this. It's Rami Makhlouf. It's Score Evening Show, and we're back right after this.
Nico hits a bouncer right back to the mound. Romano grabs it, throws to first, ball game over. The Phillies in 10 innings beat the Cubs by a score of 3-1 here at Wrigley in the series finale.
As heard right here on Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score and the Cubs Southwest Airlines Radio Network. Rami Makhlouf with you until 9 o'clock. Phone lines and text line open for you at 312-644-6767. If you want to get in on some Cubs conversation, before I have some Cubs conversation with Megan Montemuro, who covers the Cubs for the Chicago Tribune. She'll join me at 8 o'clock. We've got some room for you at 312-644-6767. Something I didn't realize until, well, just looking at the standings and reading up on the Cubs season to this point earlier today and getting ready for this show. So last year went so bad, and I know they made a run at the end, but last year was just such a tough year for Cubs fans that I kind of forgot that they got off to a hot start last year. The Cubs are 17-12 right now, and that's almost identical to the record that they had last year at this point. They were 17-11 after last year's April 28th appearance on Sunday Night Baseball. Then they went 21-34 in May and June. They slipped it 9 games under 500 all the way to last place in the National League Central before, like I said, they heated up in a little bit in the second half. They made a little bit of noise in the wild card picture, but never were really legitimately in the playoff picture after that dismal May and June that they had. Again, like I said, going 21-34 in those months after starting with basically the same record that they have to this point here today. So does it feel better or different to you? 312-644-6767. When you look at this Cubs season and the fact that they dropped those first two games not in Los Angeles, but to Los Angeles in Tokyo, and watching those games and the way that they played out. And I remember Mully and Haw saying the next morning after the second of those that it felt like games 163 and 164 of the 2024 season. When you watch the way that those played out with the offense just futile, leaving guys on base left and right and not really able to produce any runs if they weren't putting the ball over the fence. And we were watching that and going, man, that feels a lot like it did last year. Well, it's been different since. The Cubs have won 6 series, lost 2, and split 1. And a couple of things that feel the same as they did last year, or seem the same production-wise when you look at this Cubs team and last year's Cubs team. One good, one bad. They had good starting pitching last year, especially to start the season, and that was a big part of the reason why they were able to get off to that 17-11 start. And you look at their starting pitching so far this year, and even losing Justin Steele, it's kind of been the backbone of this baseball team and the thing that gives them a shot to win baseball games day in and day out. One thing that seems the same in a bad way when it comes to this team, and this is what really scares me, man, because this really was the downfall of that baseball team in the months of May and June. The bullpen is a problem again. And I know that they did some things during the course of last year, found some arms in their system, made some trades, made some moves in the offseason. Ryan Pressly obviously being the most glaring of those and the guy who's supposed to come in here and help the most and improve that bullpen the most. The bullpen is still a problem. The bullpen looks a lot like what we saw last year from the Cubs relief pitchers. As a matter of fact, right now, they sit 28th in all of baseball in ERA for a bullpen. That's just, and I read the piece from Sadev Sharma at The Athletic that the Cubs think that they have the pieces in place, that the bullpen could actually develop into a strength as the season moves on. I'll believe that when I see it. I thought they could have done more with that Cody Bellinger money that they dumped in the move of trading him to the Yankees. I thought they could have done more to help out and bolster that bullpen, but they chose not to. And I say chose because that is exactly what they did. They chose not to add more to that bullpen. They chose not to use that Cody Bellinger money on relief pitching or anything else, really, for that matter. This team came in with a lower payroll than what they had in 2024. But putting that aside for a second and looking at some of the things that are different about this baseball team than the one that started 17-11 last year and starting 17-12 this year. And you can get in on the show. Does it feel different? Does it feel better, this Cubs team, with basically the same record that they had after about a month last year? 312-644-6767. For starters, we got to start by giving these guys some credit for getting off to this kind of start with this kind of schedule. The Cubs' strength of schedule this year has been, and beyond just strength of schedule, to start the season in Tokyo the way that they did, and it's been talked about extensively. What that did in terms of especially the routines of their starting and relief pitchers and getting guys stretched out and the trip there and then coming back and going back to spring training. That was a major challenge for Craig Counsell and his pitching coach and those pitching coaches and that staff to sort of get that pitching staff ready to go and stretched out for the regular season. And the truth is, they weren't, because it was borderline impossible to do that with everything that they had to contend with. But beyond that, just the opponents that they've had in the month of April, I was, and I think most people were in the same boat with me, I was going to be more than okay with the Cubs going 500 in the month of April based on what they had to contend with starting the season in Tokyo against a World Series champion and $800 million payroll Los Angeles Dodgers. And then you had five more against the Dodgers in the month of April. You had six against the Padres. You had the Rangers come through town. You had the Diamondbacks, who are a very good baseball team. And you had the Phillies, who you just wrapped up the series with and dropped 2 of 3. That's the who's who of the National League and the playoff picture in Major League Baseball. And for the Cubs to not just go toe-to-toe, but come out on the winning end of the majority of those games and to win six series while playing that schedule, that's, again, you got to tip the cap, and that's one thing that's very different from last year. Last year, the schedule was a little bit easier in the month of April, and that 17-11 was not looking as impressive as the 17-12 that they sit at this year. But the major, major difference for this Cubs team, and the thing that has me feeling better about this Cubs team than the one that we saw last year heading into May and June that went 21-34 in those months and fell completely out of the playoff picture. Man, this is a different offense. This is a different lineup that the Cubs have this season. Going into Sunday's series finale with the Phillies, they were first in baseball in runs, RBIs, total bases, stolen bases, on-base percentage, hits, and triples. They were second in batting average, slugging, and OPS, third in walks and doubles, and sixth in homers. They're number one in a lot of these categories, top five, top six in literally every offensive category that you could possibly throw at me. This is a different lineup than what we saw last year with this Chicago Cubs team. And I think a lot of it starts with Kyle Tucker, the Tucker effect for this baseball team, because that does, and I wondered if that was enough for the Cubs to throw at this lineup and expect it to be fixed, to just, and I had a pretty good idea of the player and the hitter that Kyle Tucker was, but to just think, you're going to throw a guy like that in the middle of a lineup that was pretty futile last year and left a lot of runs on base and just couldn't seem to get any rallies going. And when they weren't putting the ball over the fence, just a brutal offensive product to watch. Kyle Tucker has had a major effect on this lineup. I mean, it seems like every time they're doing something offensively, if he's not the one in the batter's box, he's on base, and he's one of the guys who got on base, got a hit, got a walk, whatever the case might be, to extend an inning, to extend a rally, or he's standing in the on-deck circle, or he's in the hole, and the pitcher is looking over his shoulder and going, man, I better give this guy something to hit, because otherwise I'm going to have to give that guy something to hit. And that's a major impact that a superstar MVP level player can have on a lineup. But I don't think it starts there. They have six hitters with somewhere between 4 and 7 home runs. Tucker, Seiya, Carson Kelly, Michael Busch, PCA, and Dansby Swanson. That is... And when you look at the bottom of the lineup, especially when we're talking about Pete Crow Armstrong, when we're talking about the catcher duo of Carson Kelly and Miguel Amaya, man, that Cubs lineup from 6 on last year was just a dead zone. You couldn't count on getting runs from those guys on any given night. And for that bottom of the lineup to be bona fide and to be strengthened the way that it was through the development of Pete Crow Armstrong and Michael Busch and Miguel Amaya and adding Carson Kelly, the bottom of that lineup, adding that to what they have in that first 4 or 5 hitters that they got, makes this lineup a much, much deeper, much better, much stronger lineup than what they had last year. And it's not just the long ball. One of the things I love about watching this baseball team is watching them run the bases. From hustling it out to first and maybe beating a pitcher or a lazy throw over there or the stolen base or getting from first to third on a hit to the outfield, it seems like they're always just trying to get that extra 90 feet, and it's been paying off. They have 4 players with at least 6 steals, starting with PCA, but you got John Birdie, Tucker, Nico Horner. This team is making it count when they get out there on the bases, getting every base that they can possibly get, moving each other along. Again, like I said, sometimes it's a steal, but sometimes it's just getting that extra base from going from first to third on a lazy hit to the outfield. Whatever it is, the Cubs seem to always be looking to get that extra base, and that's gone a long way in addition to those home runs. And then the defense, man. The defense up the middle of, and Dansby is struggling with the bat, but the defense up the middle of Nico Horner and Dansby Swanson, they have the best outfield defense in the league with Tucker and Crow Armstrong and Ian Happ all playing Gold Glove caliber defense. Those three things, the offense and what they're doing on the bases and the power that they're hitting with, in addition to the defense that they're playing, that's got me feeling a little bit better heading into May and June than what we saw from this team last year. Even though they have the same exact record, I feel like this team is in a better position than what they were last year heading into the month of May, despite having pretty much the same record. Does it feel different? Does it feel better to you? 312-644-6767 as the Cubs sit with pretty much the same record that they had at the end of April last year. My text box isn't working. I'm going to go to the other side of the glass and Adam Studzinski, my producer, reading the text on the show tonight. What do we got talking Cubs here, Adam?
Okay, so this one's kind of ridiculous.
Okay.
So it has to do with a name you were just talking about, Dansby Swanson. You said that Dansby has been struggling at the plate this year and just
batting 181.
Yeah, and his OPS is 577. He's got a 0.0 war, which means he's a perfectly replacement player right now. However, our texter from the 630 has quite the suggestion for what to do with Dansby Swanson. Here we go. Brace yourself. Swanson needs to go down and learn how to swing the bat again. If his contact doesn't allow him to go down to Benham, I'm not sure what he's trying to say there, but he's a liability we can't afford to have is the next point here. He can't afford to have on the field. Don't argue that we need his defense. Nico can move over to shortstop and we barely miss Swanson. There's got to be somebody that can play second base halfway decent. We can't afford to give up four outs and five outs a game with this guy right now. Make up excuses for like Chris Bryant spelled with a CH. Oh, he's got a back strain or something like that. You know, or you can come up with lots of reasons for a guy to go down without anybody really knowing. So quite the take. So 630, I don't know if you're aware of this. Dansby Swanson is out of minor league options. You can't send him down.
Oh, really? Is he really?
Of course he is. Like, you can't just send down Dansby Swanson.
I know. Not to mention $26, $27, $28 million per year on
it's
that
not how
contract.
It works.
It's just not how it works.
Yeah, the only time that a guy like Dansby Swanson plays in the minors at this point in his career is if he's on a rehab assignment. That is it. It's not how this works. I do agree he needs to figure it out with the bat. Like, he's been awful. But that's the answer is not to send him down to AAA Iowa.
No, that is certainly not the answer. And his defense is valuable. And you can say we'll move Nico over there, and I'm sure you can find somebody to play second base. Are you sure about that? Because that's as good of a double play combo as there is in Major League Baseball between those two guys right now. But it is a concern, man. It is because it's not like... It's not like this just started this year. He had a lackluster 2024 as well at the plate. And he heated up at the end of the season. But going back to that contract, man, no, you can't send him to the minors. That's not an option. You're not going to do that with a Dansby Swanson. But this guy, defense and all, we're talking about a contract that, like I said, he's making between $26 and $28 million per year, depending on the year of the deal. I'm looking at it right now, and he's under contract to the Cubs through the 2029 season. That contract for no offensive production, for as good as his defense is, that contract with no offensive production will turn into an absolute albatross. It's not right now because you're winning baseball games and you're getting production elsewhere in the lineup, but a contract like that, For a guy that is giving you, what'd you say his OPS was? 555? 577. I'm sorry, I'm looking at it right now.
577.
And a 181 batting average?
Bad.
That'll turn into a major problem if he and they can't figure it out. You're not feeling the effects of it right now, but you'll feel it at some point this season, and you'll certainly feel it over the course of that contract if he doesn't figure out what's going on with that bat. Didn't he switch to the torpedo bat? Wasn't that supposed to fit? I thought the torpedo bat was the answer to everybody's problems in Major League Baseball. I thought that was going to revolutionize the sport, and everybody who made contact with the torpedo bat was gonna put it over the fence. Was it not the game changer that everybody thought it was and freaked out over when they hit 9 home runs against the Brewers, the Yankees, that is?
So 4 days ago, Rami, Evan Altman at Cubs Insider, one of our regulars here on The Score, wrote on Cubs Insider, the headline is Dansby Swanson may have ditched the torpedo bat. So we're thinking he probably has.
Go back to it.
I don't know why you would. Yeah, why?
Do something. Do something to try and get, dude. 577 is absolutely brutal. But like I said, this offense, I mean, it's hard to take much issue with what they're doing right now. I said it earlier. They're first in runs, RBIs, total bases, stolen bases, on base percentage, hits, and triples, and they're second in batting average, slugging, and OPS. That's with Dansby Swanson batting 181 with a 577 OPS. That just tells you how the rest of this lineup is getting it done. At some point, you have to think about moving Dansby down in the lineup, though. You got to, and especially the way that PCA is hitting right now. Nico is hitting the baseball pretty well right now. I'm leaving the catchers and the third baseman down at the bottom of the lineup until further notice. But I think you got to think about moving Nico and PCA up in the lineup and sliding Dansby down. If nothing else, just to take some of the pressure off of that dude, and maybe he can get that back going, because you're gonna need it. This lineup isn't gonna stay hot the entire, like, Seiya Suzuki isn't gonna have damn near a 900 OPS the entire year. You can count on Kyle Tucker doing some special things. Michael Bush and his 930 OPS, I don't think are something you can necessarily rely on for the rest of the season. You're gonna need a bat over there at shortstop, especially when you consider the fact that you don't really have an everyday third baseman right now, with Shaw going down, and we don't know if or when he'll be back up to hopefully give you a potent bat over there in the corner. You're going to need some offensive production from that shortstop position and that spot in the lineup at some point in the season, because some of these guys are going to come back down to earth and are going to slump a little bit. We'll hit a quick break, and again, we'll get back to some Cubs talk with Megan Montemuro of the Chicago Tribune. She'll join me at 8 o'clock. But after this, we got to talk about the big story that was coming out of the NFL draft and just how awful some people are. We'll talk about that right after this. It's the Score Evening Show with yours truly, Rami McLaughlin, back right after this.
The Seattle Seahawks have traded the 144th pick to the Cleveland Browns. With the 144th pick in the 2025 NFL draft, the Cleveland Browns select Shador Sanders, quarterback, Colorado.
That was what it sounded like when Shador Sanders finally went off the board in the fifth round to the Browns at pick number 144. That was the story of the draft. Rami Makhlouf with you on the Score Evening Show. Get back into some Cubs talk with Megan Montemuro of the Chicago Tribune coming up at 8 o'clock. But I said on Saturday, I was on the air with Anthony Herron during the NFL draft, when Shador Sanders got picked there at 144, I got to know what went on behind the scenes for a guy who, you know, at first was being talked about as a top 10 pick and then a first round pick, and maybe he slips into the second round, okay, maybe into the third round, to slip all the way to 144 and the fifth round to the Cleveland Browns. I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall, is what I said to Anthony Herron, and know what went on behind the scenes and in these pre-draft interviews and workouts and whatnot that could have a guy plummet like that. Like, I was imagining the old Rick James sketch on the Chappelle Show, where he walks into Eddie Murphy's house and just starts stomping on his couch. You know, that I'd imagine it'd have to be that bad for a plummet, not even a slip, but a plummet that far from top 10 potentially pick to 144.
Yo, couch.
Exactly. That's what I imagined Shador Sanders doing at these pre-draft interviews. But it wasn't quite that drastic. It wasn't quite that flagrant and that drastic. But here's, according to Bruce Feldman, what some people are saying about why Shador Sanders slipped all the way to 144. This is from one NFL wide receivers coach talking to Bruce Feldman. He's got a skill set, but no dominant trait. He's a backup at this point, and those guys have to be wired for humble support of the starter. It didn't help Sanders' stock that he didn't compete in the Senior Bowl or at the NFL Scouting Combine. If you're not a first-round lock or injured, that's going to create some pause, Feldman says. A former NFL quarterbacks coach I spoke with Sunday morning said it was, quote, not surprising that Sanders waited as long as he did in the draft. The intel I got was shocking, said the coach. The guy has no awareness about how he's coming across or the type of leverage he has or doesn't have. It comes down to this. NFL teams look at Shador Sanders as a backup quarterback and a developmental quarterback, but Shador Sanders doesn't see himself that way, and these NFL teams don't think he will see himself that way or sort of resign himself to that role. And like the one coach said, those guys have to be wired for humble support of the starter. If you walk in the door thinking you're the man and this is your organization and your franchise. And he did talk like that leading up to the draft, that he could change a franchise, that he could come in and turn a franchise around single-handedly, like he did at FAU, like he did at Colorado to some degree before he got his number retired, much to many people's surprise. He simply, according to what people are telling Bruce Feldman, just doesn't have the right mentality or the right attitude or the right aura for a backup or developmental quarterback, which is that's understandable. That's fine. I get that. What I don't get is the joy that the football world seemed to be taking in Shedeur Sanders' fall to 144 in the NFL draft. It was, now I'll admit, I'm not above this. I will admit, I laughed at some of it. There were some good jokes and memes and gifs and everything else that you'll find on the internet and in the social media world when it comes to Shedeur Sanders. I laughed at some of it, okay? I did. I'm not too big to admit that. I laughed at some of it. But at some point, and I know people are going to roll their eyes. They roll their eyes when you hear somebody say this about a kid who's got the world in his hands. I mean, even if he's not the NFL quarterback or is never the NFL quarterback that he thought he was, he's made more money than a lot of us will ever make through NIL, and Deion Sanders is his dad, and he's lived a pretty charmed life from that standpoint. But put that aside for a second. Even having all that going for him and the charmed life that he lived, this kid worked his whole life to get to this point. And the way that the world seemingly was trolling this guy for not achieving that dream or that dream not taking the form or the shape that he thought it would, I felt bad for him. At some point, I started to feel bad for Shedeur Sanders. And it was even before this stupid prank call. Do we have the prank call that was made to Shedeur Sanders?
Yes,
making
we do.
Him think. Can I hear that real quick?
This is Mickey Loomis here, the GM of the New Orleans Saints. How you doing? This is Mickey Loomis here, GM of the Saints.
How you doing?
Good. How are you, man?
Good. We're waiting on you.
Yeah, we have. It's been a long wait, man. We're gonna take you with our next pick right here, man.
It's gonna be nothing to do.
Hey, but you're gonna have to wait a little bit longer, man. Sorry about that.
Oh my God! He bought it.
I was a big prank call kid. I don't know about you, Adam. I love the Jerky Boys growing up.
Yeah, we did a few back in the day, but it was nothing like this.
That's just cruel, dude. That's just cruel. That dude worked his whole life for this moment, and you're gonna make him think he's living out that moment just to pull the rug out from under him. And then it gets even weirder because we find out that the perpetrator of that prank call was the son of Falcons defensive coordinator Jeff Ulbrich, Jax Ulbrich, 21-year-old son of defensive coordinator Jeff Ulbrich, unintentionally came across the draft contact phone number for Shedeur Sanders off an open iPad while visiting his parents' home, wrote the number down to later conduct a prank call. Jeff Ulbrich was unaware of the data, said in a Falcons statement, exposure or any facets of the prank, and was made aware of the above only after the fact. The Falcons do not condone this behavior and send our sincere apologies to Shedeur Sanders and his family, who have been in contact with to apologize to, as well as facilitate an apology directly from Jax to the Sanders family. It's stupid. It's cruel. I don't understand why you would do that. Is all this enjoyment of Shedeur Sanders slipping in the draft, is this the same thing as when I see like a boxer or a UFC fighter come out to the ring with all the swagger in the world. They do a little dance. They maybe even choreographed something with their trainer. And then they get knocked out in the first round, and I find that real happy. Is that the same funny bone that Shedeur Sanders slipping in the draft tickles for people? I don't understand it, man. I don't understand it. And like I said, at some point, started to feel bad for the dude, especially when I saw that prank call. I don't understand taking the joke that far when we're talking about a dude who's worked his entire life to achieve a dream, and most of you are sitting on your couch laughing at him. You feel good about yourselves? Everybody feel good now that we stuck it to Shedeur Sanders for working his whole life to be an NFL quarterback? It just doesn't make sense to me, man. Like I said, I can laugh at some of it, but at some point, it just goes too far, and especially when you're stealing this dude's number to prank call him. It's crazy. We got to take a look in the mirror, especially with how we conduct ourselves on social media sometimes. And I'm guilty of it. I'll admit, I have been guilty of it in the past. Prank calls and all. We'll hit a quick break. On the other side, get back to some Cubs talk. Megan Montemuro of the Chicago Tribune will join me, Rami Makhlouf. It's Score Evenings, and back right after this on Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.